It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Congress is in the home stretch, and USA Today's Paul Singer will tell us what might pass and what will probably fail by the end of the session this week.
First, the nation is facing a looming blood shortage. That's according to the American Red Cross, which says donations of blood are urgently needed and needed now.
Summer tends to be a slow season for blood donation, but it's even slower than usual this year. Over the past 11 weeks, blood donations are down about 8% nationwide. That's about 80,000 fewer donations than the Red Cross expected.
Here to talk with us about this looming shortage and to nudge potential donors is Ben Corey, External Communications Manager at the American Red Cross. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So as we mentioned, summer is a slower time usually for blood donations. What is it about this summer that seems to be slowing things down even more?
Yeah, you know, blood donations do tend to decline in the summer months for a couple reasons. You know, as people are busy with summer activities, they're busy around summer holidays, they're taking vacations, they tend to make less time in their schedules to give. And also because we host a lot of blood drives at schools, in fact, up to 20% of blood donations through the Red Cross come from high schools and colleges, donations at those types of blood drives drop by more than 80% during the summer months. Certainly this summer is no different from previous summers where donations have declined for those reasons.
But more so this summer, or are we at a typical shortage?
You know, the blood supply is not as low as it was last year. However, you know, as you mentioned in the beginning, you know, donations have declined about 8% over the last 11 weeks, resulting in about 80,000 fewer donations than expected across the country. So, we're trying to prevent an emergency situation by encouraging all eligible donors to come out and give.
What happens if we were at that emergency situation? Do you start having to, I guess, ration where blood goes and is used?
Right. You know, that potentially could mean that we're not able to supply the blood products to our hospital partners. And we would obviously have to start judiciously using blood products as needed. And obviously, we're trying to prevent that situation by encouraging donors to come out and give.
And are certain blood types needed more than others?
All blood types are needed, but especially types O negative, B negative, and A negative blood. O negative is really important because it's the universal blood type, which means it could potentially be transfused to any patient if needed. You'll see that it's used in emergency situations if a patient is rushed into a hospital and there's not a lot of time to cross-match their blood type, but yet they need a transfusion quickly. It's good to have an ample supply of type O negative on hand so they can just give them that.
Is it possible to build up a blood surplus in anticipation of like a slower summer?
You know, we always encourage eligible donors, our donors who are established with the Red Cross and perhaps donors who have not given with the Red Cross in the past, to give during the summer months in order to help prevent a situation like this. And we certainly do have a lot of dedicated donors who come in and donate. As I mentioned, the blood supply is not as low as it was last year, and that's thanks to our generous donors. But again, you know, as people become busy with the summer and schools are out of session, those donations still do tend to decline.
So give us a little blood 101. After we donate it, from our perspective as donors, it just kind of disappears. Where does it all go?
Right. So donated blood product will be tested for infectious diseases. And then assuming that's cleared, it can be separated into blood components. Now, when someone comes in and donates, they're donating a pint of what's called whole blood. Now, that whole blood can be broken up into three different separate transfusible components, red blood cells, platelets, and plasma. Red blood cells can be used, for example, for accident victims, for surgery patients, platelets for cancer patients, and plasma for burn victims, for example. So you always hear from the Red Cross, you know, when someone comes in and donates one pint of blood, they're potentially helping to save up to three lives because of those three different components.
And I know you take separate plasma and platelet donations. How are you doing on those?
As part of the urgent call, we are asking platelet donors to come in and give as well.
So how do we do in Wisconsin when it comes to donating blood? Are we pretty generous?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, this is an urgent call nationally, but donations in Wisconsin, for the most part, have kept pace with expectations. But it's important to remember that the Red Cross is a national system. So that means blood donated in Wisconsin, let's say, could potentially be given to a patient somewhere across the country if needed. So while local needs are certainly met first in Wisconsin and other places, donated blood through the Red Cross can potentially be given to folks across the country as well.
I know you're getting some media coverage, including from us. How else do you reach out and try to raise awareness of the need for blood, especially during these slower summer months?
You know, a big tool is social media. You know, I mentioned before about, you know, schools being out of session and donations decline among students. And obviously a lot of students, a lot of young people are very active on Facebook and Twitter and other social media platforms. So you see the Red Cross here in the Midwest and all across the country actually very active on Twitter, interacting with eligible donors on Facebook and Twitter and various other formats and providing them with information, you know, links to particular blood drives in their areas, some information about the blood donation process and various other things. And we find it very helpful. And it also enables us to give that information to donors, and they could pass it on to the people they follow on social media as well.
We had a call from a listener, Sophie in Waukesha. She wanted to know if after she donates her blood, the blood is sold to hospitals, or does it go to them for free? How does that work?
Sure. Like other nonprofits, we are a cost recovery model. So the fee paid by hospitals covers all the costs associated with collecting the blood, testing the blood, and processing the blood, and obviously distributing it to our hospital partners. So like other nonprofits, we are a cost recovery model.
Now, if someone's never given before, thinking, oh, this sounds like a nice idea, but a bit scary, walk them through that first ever donation they might make.
You know, most donors find the process pretty simple and relatively painless. When someone comes into a blood drive or a Red Cross blood donation center, what they'll do is they'll check in, they'll read an informational booklet, and then they can proceed to the health history. In health history, we check your iron level, your temperature, and your blood pressure, and we ask you a few questions about your health history, mostly just to make sure that you're healthy enough to give. And then once you're out of that, you go to the actual donation. Now, the actual donation, the part where you're sitting on the donor bed giving, only takes about 10 minutes. So you're only on that bed giving for about 10 minutes. And then after that, you can stick around. We recommend you stick around for about 15 minutes to enjoy some free snacks. So from the time you enter a blood drive, from the time you leave, only takes about an hour. And as I mentioned before, that 1 hour is potentially really powerful because one donation can help save up to 3 lives.
One thing I was wondering, I know a lot of people can't donate for a lot of reasons. If they've lived in a certain place for a while, a disease history, that sort of thing. Does the Red Cross need non-donor volunteers?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, volunteers are really the core of the organization. If somebody is ineligible to donate for some reason, they can visit redcrossblood.org or call 1-800-RED-CROSS to learn more about volunteering or other ways they can participate.
And then I gather that the Red Cross often gets an upsurge of donations after a disaster, which I know you're grateful for. Do you want to make a pitch for making that preemptive donation and not waiting for the disaster to strike?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the need for blood is constant. Every 2 seconds, someone in America needs a life-saving blood transfusion. In fact, the Red Cross needs to collect 15,000 pints of blood each day. So regardless of the season, regardless if there's a disaster or not, we constantly need a steady stream of donors year-round all across the country.
All right. And do things usually pick back up in the fall after those slower summer months?
They do. In the spring and fall months, things tend to get back to normal as people fall into their regular schedules.
All right, Ben. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's Ben Corey. He's External Communications Manager at the American Red Cross. Congress is only in business for a few more days with some big issues still unresolved, including highway funding, borders, and VA hospitals.
Paul Singer joins us now for a rundown on the race to the finish. He's the politics and Congress editor at USA Today, and he joins us each week at this time for the latest from the legislative branch. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks. Nice to be with you again.
So before we dig into the specific issues here, is there a sense that you're getting that Congress has the pedal to the metal, they're trying to get stuff done?
No. there is a sense that they would like to get the heck out of here Thursday afternoon and hopefully forget about everything else if they can. There are a couple of issues they really are trying to resolve, but, you know, I'm not particularly enthusiastic.
More like high school kids before summer vacation or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly. Like, do you want to get your finals done? No, but if, you know, you have to.
And yet there is some important stuff on the table right now. Let's look first at the veterans' health care reform that looks pretty promising. How is that standing right now?
That's the one where they've really made some progress. Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, he's independent, but parties with the Democrats, and Jeff Miller, the Republican from the House, the chairman of the Veterans Committee in the House, they basically fought it out over the weekend, and they argued and they yelled at each other, and then they agreed, and then they huffed and they puffed, and then they came up with a deal, which is pretty much the way it's supposed to work. And it looks like a deal that can probably get some support. It's a chunk of money for the veterans. It's about $10 billion. To allow veterans to go seek care outside the veterans, the VA, the Veterans Administration, Department of Veterans Affairs, if they're not getting treatment and they're stuck on a waiting list. And then, you know, part of the compromise is, well, they'll have to take some of that money out of current veterans programs and out of the current budget for the VA. So, you know, again, that makes nobody happy entirely, but that's a compromise, we call it, the old school compromise. And I think it's got a pretty good chance of passing because everybody wants to do something on veterans issues. Now, I can't swear they're going to get it done in the next 3 days before they leave. It may end up hanging off until after they get back from recess.
But of everything on the table, is this the thing that you look at and you say, this, if anything gets a green light, it's going to be this?
I think so, yeah. I would, if we'd had this conversation yesterday at this time, I would have said the highway bill was the other one that was going to go smoothly. And then last night, and again, this is a deal to extend the highway bill, the highway trust fund, through May of next year, sort of a temporary patch while they work out a longer deal. The thing is, last night in the Senate, they, for reasons that escaped me, decided to tinker with the bill and change the deadline. So they'd only extend it through December in the Senate bill. So now they have to go back and argue with the House whether it would be December or May. Once again, that slows everything down. They need to get this thing done before they go away because people stop spending money on road construction when the trust fund runs out in August. So I would have told you yesterday this was the one that was going to go first. Now I'm just not so sure.
Now, the trust fund has been in trouble for a little while. What is it that you think is most pressing here when we look at this trust fund?
Well, you know, the problem is, and it's your fault, that is, you know, all of us, it's our fault, because we are getting more gas efficiency out of our cars. And when you drive a fuel-efficient vehicle, you cheat the gas trust fund, sorry, the highway trust fund, because the highway trust fund is funded with a gas tax. So if you drive 55 miles per gallon in your Prius, you are cheating the highway trust fund out of the gas tax it's supposed to have.
And bumping the gas tax, probably not going to happen.
Right. Well, you know, Congress hates raising taxes. So that's the problem. I mean, the fundamental problem is the way this thing is funded is with a tax that can't be raised while fuel efficiency increases. We're using less gas per mile. By definition, it's a mathematical problem. We're not going to have as much money to fund the construction we need.
And this is bad for a number of reasons, right? We've got infrastructure in states of disrepair, and also it supposedly fuels the economy, not just cars. You know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, every year we have these conversations about the price of gas, and if the price of gas is going up or down, people are driving less. If people are driving less, or in this case, if they're driving less because they can't get on the roads, or the roads are closed, or the roads are broken down, or the bridge collapsed, it stops economic activity. I mean, the roads are the lifeblood of our economy. That's where everybody goes to shop. They drive there.
All right, so some tinkering being done on the highway trust fund, so we don't really know what's going to happen with that.
Right.
And looking at another issue that we've been tracking, the border crisis, we've been talking about this with you, in fact, over the last several weeks. So what is the response from Congress been, and where do things stand today?
Well, things stand today in a really ugly mess. It again, part of the problem here is, one, the government needs money to address the fact that all these kids are sort of stuck at the border and have been scooped up and are in detention, essentially, at various places while we figure out what to do with them. The second problem is a philosophical issue, which is this. should we change the existing law to make it easier to deport back to their home countries kids from Central America? The Obama administration initially said this is what they wanted to do. The Republicans immediately agreed. The Democrats balked and have backed away from it, saying it's unfair to these kids. And that's where we're stuck now. The Senate passed a bill that basically didn't talk about this issue at all. All it was funding for these agencies to deal with the kids who are here. The House is in the process of producing a bill that is basically just the opposite. It addresses the immigration issue of sending the kids back more quickly, and it has a very, very small funding level to help process the kids. So we are now at the point where we have two chambers of Congress taking directly divergent approaches to this problem. I don't see any way they finish this by tomorrow night.
Now, the issue you're talking about, the 2008 deportation bill, I understand that was something that was supported by the Bush administration. Do you have any background there about why it's changed shape so much over the course of those years?
Well, it's a fairly, I mean, if you think about it, it makes some sense. The way that law was written, they basically said, if you are an immigrant kid caught coming across the border from Canada or Mexico, the border guards can basically just toss you back into your country. They can make a very quick decision that you are not a genuine asylum seeker and you should be simply returned without a whole lot of process, without a whole lot of no hearing, no judge, no nothing. Other Central American nations were not treated the same. Those kids, if they arrive, they're supposed to go before an immigration judge. There's supposed to be a hearing process and all this stuff, and it takes longer. The whole idea here is to simply extend that barrier and say, well, not just Mexican kids, but other Central American kids, the border authorities can basically instantly decide they should just be put back on a plane and sent back. That's what the philosophical argument is. And that is what is now being the Democrats, like I said, the White House initially thought that was a good idea, but immigration advocates and Democrats have been outraged by it and say that it's not fair to these kids. You could be returning them to a crisis situation, and it's bad.
All right, so obviously some big talking has to happen on both sides before we get anywhere on that.
Correct.
Is anything, do you think, going to happen by Friday there?
Nope. I doubt it.
And let's look at another issue that's been out there, the issue of impeachment and...
Yeah, that's a joke. That's a fundraising tactic for both sides. No one's going to impeach Obama. Impeachment would have to start in the House, and the Speaker of the House has said he's not going to do it. So it's not going to happen. But if you are on the sort of far conservative end of the political spectrum, you like to send out fundraising appeals saying, this president is terrible, and we have to impeach him. Send me $100. And if you're on the Democrat or liberal side of the political spectrum, you'd like to send out emails saying, this president is in trouble. The crazy Republicans want to impeach him. Send me $100. So it's just a fundraising ploy on both sides.
Right. And John Boehner has said as much. On the other hand, he said what we are looking at is not so much impeachment, but we're looking at this issue between the legislative and the executive branch and trying to figure out where the balance of power lies in the courts. And that is going to happen, it sounds like.
Yeah, probably. I mean, they're going to file suit against the president for unilaterally delaying the employer mandate in the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare law.
How big a deal is that?
I don't know. It's odd because obviously the Republicans wanted that mandate delayed. Their argument is that Obama is not implementing the laws the way they were passed, and this is sort of a stalking horse for that argument. I honestly am not enough of a legal scholar to know whether they have any leg to stand on. There was a hearing where there was an argument made that they do have a legal leg to stand on, but the person who was making that argument had previously written the opposite. So I don't know. You'd have to get a lawyer who knows better than I do, but it's certainly not going to be anytime soon that this is resolved.
All right. One thing we do know, there have been farewells to Eric Cantor this week in the form, I guess, of a montage-y style video highlighting some of the greatest hits of his career. What has that been like? Has it been emotional?
No, somebody. Well, it's been emotional for the Republicans in the House caucus because, again, you know, you forget the fact that these guys, guys and gals, in Congress work together, work close together, get to know each other, and care about each other in some way. And then, you know, Cantor was a stunning defeat, was considered someone most likely to be the next Speaker of the House, and now is basically going to fade into obscurity. And you know, you have to, on a personal level, feel bad for the guy, and certainly his colleagues feel bad for him. So they put out this video that was kind of his greatest hits of his career video, and one of my pals was joking that they ought to be playing the sort of NFL Films theme song behind it, you know.
And we're going to leave it there. Paul, thank you for joining us. That was Paul Singer, Congressman Politics Editor at USA Today.
The tight bass line kicks off our next conversation that's chic with good times. What is it about an awesome bass line that really makes a good song pop? Some new research looks at the brain science behind the bass.
And we want to hear from you. What is your favorite bass line of all time? Do you love the bass or does it just kind of wash over you? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
In a few minutes, we'll hear from a bass line expert at notrouble.com. First, Laurel Trainer has researched the science of bass and our brains. She's the director of the McMaster Institute for Music and the Mind and professor of psychology, neuroscience, and behavior at McMaster University. Laurel, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So how did you try to analyze the way we hear and process bass sounds?
Well, one of the things that we were really interested in was why the rhythm seems to be carried primarily in the bass range instruments and melodies usually in the higher instruments. So we decided to look at the hypothesis that our sense of timing is actually better for the lower pitched instruments. And so we looked, we presented a series of tones where we had high tones and low tones at the same time. And occasionally we played one of the high tones too early or one of the low tones too early. And we looked at the brain's response to those mistakes in the timing. And what we found was the brain was more sensitive to timing errors in the low tones than in the high tones. And so from that, we conclude that actually the brain is better able to encode timing with the lower pitches than with the higher pitches.
And Laurel, is that true across the board for both men and women?
Yes, it is. Both men and women. It also seems to apply across cultures. We didn't study people that were not from Western cultures, but if you look at how music is written across different cultures, it's most often the case that the main bass line, or the main rhythm, the main beat gets set by the bass-ranged instruments.
And do you think we're using this timekeeper function of bass sounds, even if we're not actively keying in on listening to the bass?
I do, in fact. I think when we hear the rhythm, and it can be actually in other, you know, range instruments as well, but particularly in the bass, that's what really makes us want to move to the beat. And we also know that our brains are set up so that when we hear an auditory rhythm, it actually activates motor regions in our brain that have to do with timing of movements. It's almost as if it's priming our bodies to move. And it's really these bass instruments that seem to be the main driving force behind that.
And Laurel, I got to ask you, since we're talking about this half hour, do you have a favorite bass line?
Well, there's so many great bass lines out there. It's really hard to say. I'm kind of partial to some Michael Jackson, Beat It or
Nice.
But there's some other cool bass lines out there too, like, you know, Pink Floyd, you know, Hey You. It's a very interesting bass line. But there's so many examples.
That's what I found as I started digging them up too. Laurel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Laurel Trainer. She's director of the McMaster Institute for Music and the Mind at McMaster University.
That's the science, and now we're going to get to the music. Our next guest is Corey Brown, the CEO and founder of NoTrouble.com. The subtitle is Nothing But Bass. We asked him to share some of the best bass lines of all times, and he asked the NoTrouble community for suggestions, too. Corey, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you've got this whole website pretty much devoted to bass. What do you love about it?
Well, it's a funny story. I mean, when I was a little kid, my parents, this is in the early 70s, my parents bought one of those really killer 1970s stereo systems, mm-hmm. and we had a lot of albums in the house. And for whatever reason, my dad just cranks the bass on his stereo. And I remember feeling it as a little kid, feeling the bass in the floor. And I wasn't quite sure what that was until I was in the fifth grade, and the music teacher came down and said, "Who wants to join orchestra?" And I was like, "Well, it's music. I want to end," because I was just, you know, drawn to it. And she had me try all the instruments, violin, viola, cello. But when I hit the bass and hit that low E string on the bass and felt that vibration, I knew that was it. I was like, it connected. And I was like, that's the instrument I want to play. So I was about 10 years old. It was a long time ago now. And so, you know, that was my first love in music. That's what I was drawn to. And that's what I've stuck with all these years.
Well, what makes a great bass line? Is it something that's memorable and catchy, or is it the virtuoso performance that's really all over the place? What makes a bass line great?
Well, you know, this is going to possibly get me in trouble with some of our readers because the bass has become such a diverse instrument. It's become a solo instrument more recently than the traditional role of a supportive instrument. And you know, I'll talk more about the old school, the more supportive instrument, and to back up some of the things that Laurel said, scientifically, the musical explanation is that there are three key ingredients to music: melody, harmony, and rhythm. And the bass is actually responsible for two-thirds of those, the harmony and the rhythm. And so it's what propels the music forward. It's what, you know, when a song is grooving, it's because of the bass. And I think, you know, the old school definition of that is it's those memorable lines that whether people recognize, oh, that's a bass guitar or not, they know the line. And so, you know, Money by Pink Floyd is a great example of that. You know, Walk on the Wild Side by Lou Reed is a great example of that. And probably one of the simplest bass lines ever is on Under Pressure by Queen. Mm. But they're iconic. And, you know, we were sitting around talking about this before the show, and it was funny how so much of what we kept coming up with were actually the simplest bass lines ever, but they're just so memorable, and they, you know, they are the song. Come Together by the Beatles, it's like instant. As soon as you hear the bass, and that's what the song is, right? It's the bass line, and as soon as you hear it, you know what song it is. Same with Money, same with all the other ones I mentioned. And of course, we asked our readers, and because there's such variety and the bass is such a, you know, incredibly flexible instrument, we got a lot of the really technical stuff. So you get a lot of the Geddy Lee and Les Claypool and stuff like that, and they're fantastic, and they can do all the things that I mentioned, but their music tends to be a bit more, I would say more cult oriented and more, you know, you see a lot of musicians at their concerts.
Yeah, you got a ton of responses. It was pretty amazing. And we're going to hear from our listeners, too. You can join us starting right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're going to take a listen to one of Corey's favorite bass lines when he just mentioned Here Comes Money.
So, Corey, bass lines often that ostinato, they repeat the same things again and again. Is that what part of what makes them so infectious as we hear that line anchoring the song throughout?
I think for that one, yeah. And like I said, you know, we were kind of surprised when we looked at our list at how simple a lot of the bass lines were. But then one of them on our list was James Jamerson, who had this knack for never repeating a note. Ooh. Or a phrase in a line, and he's the gold standard for many of us. You know, the Motown, he was the Motown sound. He was, you know, the if you watched anything about the, you know, Standing in the Shadows of Motown, it was a lot about James Jamerson and the bass playing he did behind all those great singers.
Well, Corey, based on your audience selection there, I pulled a clip of James Jamerson and Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. Let's give a listen.
Yeah. There's too many of you to cry. Brother, brother, brother.
And that's a song. Now, a lot of the ones that your community had, I thought, oh, yeah, that one. And this is a song I love, and there's so much going on and what's going on, right? The vocals, there's horns,
right.
Keyboard, all the crowd scene. I never keyed in on the bass line. He's doing really amazing stuff in the background there.
He was just, I mean, flat out genius. I you know, when I listen to his bass lines, I can't even fathom how he does, how he did it. And we actually have an isolated clip on the site where all you hear is Marvin Gaye's voice and James Jamerson's bass, and it's like the song is complete. You don't miss the other instruments. It's just, he was untouchable in terms of what he could do on the bass. And I, you know, the Motown, the number one hits coming out of Motown, I think they said exceeded the sum total of the Beatles, Elvis, and the Stones combined. And it was all because of these Funk Brothers, and anchored by James Jamerson.
So interesting to hear Rob sitting next to me singing the bass line, because I couldn't sing it back to you to save my life, and I know that song. I can sing you the melody, you know, all day long, but that's where my ear goes, to the top of the song, the music, not to the bottom, to the bass.
And Corey, we were talking about this. I'll, like, sing songs to Veronica or to my wife, and she's like, how's that song go? And I'll sing the bass line, and my wife, for example, will say, yeah, do you know the words? Some of us key on the bass, and some of us don't. What's up with that?
You know, it's funny because since I've been playing bass so long, when I tell people I play the bass, and it's changed a little bit over time, but people are like, well, what's that? And they think it's just, you know, we're another guitar player up there if we're playing electric. And, you know, I don't really know the answer to it, but I can tell you this. If you take the bass out of the mix, everybody will know it, and the song will just, it'll die. So, you know, we're like the offensive linemen of you know, the music world. You know, like the receivers and the quarterback get all the glory, but, you know, if the offensive linemen aren't doing their job, nobody's doing anything.
All right, so we got to show a little respect for the bass today, and here to help us do that is Dave in Hustisford. Hey, Dave, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, my pick was Traveling Without Moving by Jamiroquai. The bass player was Stuart Zender. He's now the former bass player for the group, but it's one of those songs where if you, it's impossible not to feel good when you hear it.
All right.
And it's hard not to dance as well, or at least attempt to dance.
All right. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Dave. I don't know that one. What about you guys?
I don't either. I saw you had Jamiroquai on your comments list, though, Corey. Do you want to give props there?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Jamiroquai, those guys, that's all groove. It's all like, I mean, like the caller said, it's, if that doesn't get you moving, you better check your pulse, because those guys just bring it. And Stuart Zender, the former bass player, yeah, he's definitely one of those guys that just, he's the big reason why.
We're talking about the best bass lines of all time with Corey Brown. He's founder and CEO at NoTrouble.com.
And you can join us. Are you a big fan of the bass sound? What is your nominee for the greatest or most memorable bass line or bass player of all time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation about the bass and the best bass lines of all time, listening to one right now come together. Beatles, of course. We're talking to Corey Brown, founder and CEO of NoTrouble.com.
And you can come together and give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page with your bass favorites. And we'll go right back to our callers. We've got Mackenzie on the line in Waukesha. Mackenzie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us?
Charles Mingus, not only one of the greatest bass composers of all time, but his Haitian fight song is quite possibly one of my favorites ever.
Mackenzie, thank you so much. This show is an exercise in me kicking myself for not pulling even more clips. And that's the one, how do you leave Charles Mingus off, Corey?
You don't. I mean, yourself,
sorry.
But, you know, like I said, I'm going to get in trouble for missing a lot of people that we should cover, but we don't have enough time.
Can we also give a shout out while we're talking about people who have been left off to Esperanza Spalding, who is, you know, a bass player and I think a rarity in this, a woman, right? Are there seem to be many more men bass players than women?
Yeah, historically that's been the case, and we interviewed Rhonda Smith, who has been touring with Jeff Beck lately, about that. And you know, we had an interesting conversation about it because it's starting to change. And the reason people, you know, seem to agree it's starting to change is thanks to the web and YouTube. And, you know, so it wasn't an instrument that girls tended to go to. And but now they're seeing people like Tal Luckenfield, who played with Jeff Beck and others, and Esperanza Spalding, and they have a hero in which to say, oh, you know, I want to do that too. And so we're seeing a lot more players nowadays, and you know, it may be that they were always there, but we didn't have YouTube. But there is one that is probably one of the most recorded. Well, it's definitely one of the most recorded bass players of all time, is Carol Kaye, who did. I think she's recorded like 10,000 songs from the Beach Boys and Sonny and Cher and all the TV and movie soundtracks from the 60s and 70s. So they were definitely around. They just weren't in the spotlight.
And we have a comment from Joe on Facebook, who's backing you up there on Carol Kaye. He says she played some of the most famous bass lines on some of the most famous pop tunes of all time and got little recognition because she was behind the scenes and maybe because she was a woman.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of those people didn't get credit. I mean, certainly James Jamerson didn't get credit. They just, you know, they would list the singers. So it was the Beach Boys. It wasn't the Beach Boys and the studio musicians. And so I would think it's not because she's a woman, but it was because none of the studio musicians ever got the credit.
All right, we'll go back to our callers now. We've got Joe on the line in Oakfield. Joe, hi.
Yes, hello. Hey, thank you for taking my call. The bass lines I have are not quite as complex as the ones you've been talking about. They're just kind of, I like them because they're simple and they're out front. And the three I have on my list here is White Lines of Grandmaster Flash. That just goes through the whole song. And then Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang. And then Brick House by, of course, the Commodores. So
all right,
Joe,
thank you for those suggestions. We've got Brick House. Let's give that one a listen. And that's one, Corey, you talked about the bass driving the dancing. It's hard even for a non-dancer like me to not move at least a little bit in my seat. That seems like the prototype of make you move bass lines.
I mean, that's it right there. That's Exhibit A. It's awesome.
Are there any other that fit that bill for you, that kind of funky bass line that just locks in with the drums and drives the dancing?
Well, you know, there's a lot of the stuff from the 70s, like, you know, Good Times by Chic. And but there's also, you know, you talk about Bob Marley, and his musical director was Aston Barrett, known as, you know, Family Man, the bass player. And he wrote almost all those songs. And, you know, one of our readers mentioned Stir It Up, which is definitely one of those tunes where, yeah, the bass is the big reason for a lot of those songs as well. And you have, like, if you've seen the documentary, which is just wonderful, called Muscle Shoals, talks about the studio down in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and primarily the bass player down there, David Hood. And he was behind the Staple Singers' I'll Take You There, which is another one of those just totally iconic bass lines. So all the stuff coming out of Muscle Shoals was just remarkable.
Well, you mentioned Stir It Up there, which is one of my favorites. So let's listen to that one. And I think you could still have that song, I think, if you didn't have anything else but the voice and the bass.
That's right, because you could feel, like, when you're listening to that song, you could feel the bass is pulling you through the song, right? It's driving. It's that harmony and rhythm in combination that's just pulling everybody through the song, and everything else is just kind of a layer over top of that.
All right, back to our callers now with Kevin on the line in Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. My memorable range goes from the classical Pachelbel Canon in D up through, I don't know who did the recording, the opening of the Barney Miller TV show.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't pull the clip of Barney Miller, but I can sing that one.
Yeah, sing it. See, again, I don't remember it. Where's the melody?
Well, that's how it's. But that one starts with just the bass line. It's isolated.
Is
that it really stands out? Yeah.
Right.
Barney Miller.
That's how the whole theme song starts out.
Yeah. Is that one? Do we know who did that one, or is that an anonymous session musician, Corey?
I don't recall who it was. I really don't.
That's a research project for our listeners. Post on Facebook if you know who did that Barney Miller theme song and played bass on that track. I'd love to find out. I'm curious.
Yeah, I got to go back and listen to it now. Okay, let's take another caller. Thanks a lot, Kevin. On to Rado in Milwaukee. Hi there.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got to say that my favorite bass line would have to be the opening melody from Jackson 5, I Want You Back. That immediately, for me at least, is a foot tapper, no doubt. I mean, that's my simple answer to the bass line, my favorite.
We've got it. There it is.
Sounds like another groovalicious bass line
yeah,
there.
Yeah, definitely. I was listening to this one on headphones, and we had other producers from shows coming in. It's like, oh, I love that bass line. That's one of my favorites. That came up in your comments log too, Corey, didn't it?
Yeah, and I think there is maybe a little bit of disagreement on who that was, but I think the leading vote is Wilton Felder. And, it's just one of those classic bass lines. That, you know, again, you could feel it propelling the song, and everything else is just kind of a layer on top of that.
Corey, do you think bass players get their due these days?
I mean, it's changing, and it's changing with the role of the instrument. When you think about the electric bass, which wasn't invented by Leo Fender, but it was mass-produced by Leo Fender, and so you think about an instrument that's not very old because it started being mass-produced in 1951, and it wasn't even popular then. It's becoming much more a solo instrument. So if you've ever seen Victor Wooten, for example, you know, he can put on a one-man show that is just phenomenal with his bass. And he does it, and many others like him will do it, with looping. And so they'll hit the bass for a percussive sound. It kind of lays down a drum track, and then they'll play like a traditional bass line, and then they'll start playing melodies and chords on top. And it's like a one-man band. Guys like Victor Wooten, you know, those guys are propelling it forward in such a big way, and being the focal point of the music and out front. And, you know, for me, that really started with who I, you know, my number one guy is Jaco Pastorius, who was, you know, just remarkable and played the bass like a horn player sometimes, but could play the 16th note grooves. And he grew up listening to Jerry Jamot, who's a bass player not many people know, but everybody's heard because he was on all those Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles and B.B. King stuff with Atlantic Records in the 70s.
Corey, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it.
That's Corey Brown, founder and CEO of NoTrouble.com. You can keep sharing your favorite bass lines over at the Central Time Facebook page. Got a link to NoTrouble.com where you can see what the bass community is suggesting too.